My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is usually a German podcast, but once in a while, or sometimes even more often, I love to do also English episodes because there's so many great musicians and colleagues out there who I want to interview. I have studied classical singing, but I love to sing contemporary and experimental music. And if you want to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. And yeah, you will find everything on my website. There is also a monthly newsletter. And yeah, in this podcast, I talk about themes all around new contemporary music. I'll share with you the backgrounds, the insider knowledge, and I really want to bring you the human beings out of the new music world much closer. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is a very important newspaper in Germany, and I think they even have English articles in their online version. Today I have a wonderful guest for you, an artist who I admire a lot, and I've met her before. We met again. You will hear this in the interview, obviously. And this artist is Alwin Pritchard. Hello, Alwin. Alwin Pritchard. I welcome you today into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
It's so exciting because we're actually sitting in a monastery in a room in Trier, and we will be performing tomorrow, hopefully outside, but it depends how the weather will be. And yeah, so I took the opportunity to interview you, and we met a few years ago.
Yes.
I think it was a birthday performance for Gerhard & Kunze in Essen, and I remember you did such an amazing body percussion.
Okay.
And yeah, I was very, very impressed. And so I'm really excited to have you here. And hopefully I can also see some of your work tomorrow.
Yes, likewise, huh? We're going to be running about quite a lot, I think.
Well, it depends how the weather will be.
It depends how the weather will be. We may be very stationary inside Tufa.
Yeah, it can be. I'm always curious, how did you find your way into what we call new and experimental music?
Yes, I mean, I didn't really find my way. I was sort of born into an environment where, you know, I don't remember being in an environment where my dad, who's a composer, Gwyn Pritchard, where he was rehearsing. He had an ensemble. There were always musicians around. My mother's a singer. So really, I've been going to rehearsals, and experimental music has been part of my life since before I was really aware of the world, actually. I was kind of given it on a plate, is what happened.
So what is very natural for you to do the same? I mean, it could also have happened that you say, okay, this is what my parents do and I, whatever, become a lawyer or something like
yes.
that.
I mean, I did want to be an Egyptologist for a while.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, very strangely enough. And I guess I was always, but I was always, maybe the thing that I thought I might be more interested in doing was writing and acting, which I kind of do now anyway. And I was playing the violin and the piano from when I was very, very little. I think I intermittently really, really enjoyed playing and really hated it and wasn't always very good at practicing and had a complex relationship with that. So I definitely wasn't going to be like a virtuoso violinist from, you know, I think that was clear. I was pretty good, but I never had the kind of the real drive, you know. But it was interesting because my bedroom was next to my dad's, kind of one floor up, but shared a wall with my dad's music room. And he would often compose at night. So I fell asleep to the sound of him testing out intervals and trying things out. And I really, really, really liked that. And I remember having this feeling that I will compose one day, but not yet. I don't know why I had that, but I was like, no, I'll do it, but I'm not going to do it yet. And then I remember suddenly when I was 16, I think, just sitting down and writing a piano piece, you know, and then writing another piano piece. And suddenly then it was really, it kind of took off very, very quickly, actually.
And what kind of training did you do then?
Then I went to the Guildhall for a year, and then I transferred to the Royal Academy of Music. And I studied composition there, and then I did a postgrad in composition there. And then after a few years, I went to Bristol University and did a master's in musicology, and then I did a PhD in composition there. So I kind of, because I felt after studying at a music college. I wanted to go into a more academic environment, and I wanted to kind of go into the more academic side. And in fact, I started my PhD, started also being a kind of musicologically slanted thing. And then I switched over to
composition. Okay, so it was really the compositioning that draw you. So how did you get then to do the stuff with your voice and your body?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes. I guess as a kid, then my mum was singing. So I had my father composing and I had my mum singing, and they would often work together. And I really enjoyed singing. And when I was at the, I think it started when I was even at the Guildhall, but certainly when I was at the Academy, I started having private lessons with Linda Hurst.
Oh.
And that was fantastic. She was really magnificent, actually. And I had a wonderful, wonderful kind of period studying with her. And I also did a lot of very, very interesting breathing technique work, Smith technique, with a woman called Dinah Harris, which was really, really great for making the voice easy, actually. And I think both her and Linda it was really all about, in very, very different ways, completely different singers in completely different worlds, but it was all about flexibility, mobility, accessibility. Mm-hmm. And I think when I then went, after I finished at college and I was teaching singing and I was teaching the piano, but I was really kind of going in a direction as a composer more. I wasn't trying to be a singer. And when I, in my early 30s, I then started improvising. I formed an improvisation quintet with a bunch of people in Norway called Fat Battery, and also a trio with Roland Sutherland in the UK, flute player, and my partner, Torolf Tuesdad, called Myrtle. And so there were a couple of constellations that I was in where I felt that I could do what I wanted. I wasn't answerable to anyone as a singer. I wasn't a singer. I had a voice. Mm-hmm. I felt like a composer who felt that she... So at this point in her life, it was really okay for me to do whatever I wanted to do with my voice. And I kind of followed the principle that if it feels good, it's fine, even if it sounds painful, you know, even if so... And just being very free and investigating techniques and having fun with it. And doing a lot of, for my warm-up, actually a lot of yin yoga.
Oh, cool.
So getting away from vocal exercises, getting away from all that, and just focusing on the body. If the body's right, if the breath is right, the voice is there.
Yes, I mean, it's all about preparation. That's what I tell my students a lot, that I think at least 90% is the breathing part, the how you take your breath, and then the singing happens by itself.
Yeah.
But it's, I think in the end, also for me, it's hard to get there, because I think when my teachers told me that also, I was like, I want to sing. I don't care about breathing.
Yeah.
To really be patient enough or to really feel that. No, it's the whole thing. I mean, we sing with the whole body.
Yeah, we really, really do. It's true. I mean, it's interesting because I came, like I was trying to learn some classical repertoire and, you know, opera repertoire stuff when I was in my early 20s. And then when I went into improvising and then it became also, I've been really into physical. Mm-hmm. So I went to Israel to study with the Bat Sheva Dance Company there, Gaga Intensive fortnights that they have. And I've been really doing Butoh classes and lots of physical work, lots and lots of physical work. And that really also started really late, like in my 30s and 40s is when I started doing all of that. And feeling that actually that was so much more important than doing vocal exercises. But then finding that, so if you like, the kind of chain of events was body and breath, free improvisation, and now I think I've gone back to singing Schubert or singing Fauré, and I sing it the way I want to sing it. I don't worry about, you know, whether it's the right kind of, I really don't care about what the received wisdom is about the interpretation of these things.
I think that's great, because especially with those songs, I think we really have to make them our own. And
yes.
And I think for me also, I sing this repertoire too in public, but I think because of all the contemporary music I've sung, I also, in a way, don't care in a good way. And I just enjoy singing it. And and maybe something else comes out than people are used to.
Exactly. But as you say, you have to make it your own. And that took me a long time to feel that my experience of the world, my kind of development of my body and my, like a... that actually it was easier for me to do that. You talked about your students wanting mm-hmm. to kind of, and I know that, I remember that too, really, like, you know, rushing ahead. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really understandable too, actually. Now I feel like I can, in a way, I can kind of, I mean, it's a bit like rushing ahead. I can be more careless, but only because I've done all the...
I know.
Yeah, which is lovely
Or we know where to let go. I'm also curious about Linda Hirst, because, I mean, she also sang a lot of contemporary music. Did she work with you on that, or just classical repertory, or a mixture?
We did a mixture of stuff, actually, but we did quite a lot of classical repertory. Mm-hmm. But we did some Cage, Charles Ives, I guess, mm-hmm. but not a lot of very contemporary stuff, actually. It was more the classical repertory.
I also had a very strange or funny experience a long while ago. I had a stipend for Darmstadt, and I think it was the first time for years that they would invite vocalists again, and they had a voice teacher. It was Kurt Wittmer from Switzerland, a very interesting voice teacher who teaches very different than everybody else, also through movement. But the shocking thing was, I was in Darmstadt. I was young. I wanted to do contemporary music. We come into his class, all the singers who were eager to sing some weird stuff. And he's like, okay, do you have a Schubert song? Do you have this and that? And we're like, hey, this is Darmstadt. And he's like, well, but if you can't sing Schubert... It's all the same. You have connection to your body. And after a few days, some of the other teachers came in. They were so fascinated. We're in Darmstadt and he's doing Mozart with them. But they were like, somehow it's great.
Yeah, I think it is great. And I think maybe that's also something I've realized as a composer too. Well, maybe I always felt it as a composer, more connection to Beethoven, you know, that there was more of a connection, that line that you follow when you're mm-hmm. when you're learning to be a composer. And maybe it's partly that I think the institutional environment of the classical music world, the classical singing world, is rather specific in my mind. I don't have a huge amount of experience of it as a professional, in fact, because mm-hmm. I never went into that world. But I always had a feeling, you know, that it was rather different in its mind to the world of contemporary singing, whereas Beethoven's dead. I've got no idea. You know, we're kind of, you know, all composing is contemporary now, whereas all singing is not. And those institutions, those environments, those milieu are really quite different. And it's a shame, because actually it's all an expression of our being in the world, you know.
There should be so many differences. And, I mean, you are composing for the human voice. How is it for you? Do you find it challenging? Or, I mean, do you just perform your pieces yourself? Or could I also sing a piece by yours?
Well, why? Yes. I mean, I'd love it if you did. Cool. It's varied a lot, actually. So I would say that like 20 odd years ago, I was writing pieces that were, I think, more conventional in terms of kind of how they're written, how they're notated. They were not for physical performers mm-hmm. at all. And they're more kind of, I guess, more classically singy as contemporary pieces. Mm-hmm. So I've written a few of those. But then I started to work more with kind of instruction texts that are more open, kind of game type pieces for the voice. I've written a book of poetic invitations to create site-specific sound pieces. I'm going to give you a copy later.
I would love to have one.
I'm going to give you a copy. And those pieces are like short poems, in fact. So anyone can interpret them in any way, as long as they are thinking about what they're doing in a site-specific mm-hmm. way. And the performances that I do myself, I organise them, like the Vitality Forms performances or Hospice Lazy, which is really, it's not a vocal piece, it's a physical piece, but I then make myself structures, which actually I've had a few people contact me and say, you know, can I perform this piece? So I've actually made, for one of the Vitality Forms pieces, I've made, again, a text score, because I would rather that there are certain things about the performance that are very, very specific to me. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that I would like to be there as kind of pillars for other performers. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, given that that human being is so different, they would need to have the freedom to bring mm-hmm. very different things into the voice, into the body. So I try and keep that in mind when I'm making the score. But these very physical pieces that I've done, they are text scores, in fact. So yes, you definitely can.
Yes, I want one.
I'm giving you that. You're also having that after this interview. Yeah.
But I find it also very thoughtful that you really think about what is possible for you, or maybe fits you and your talents, and that you're so open and think like, oh, maybe it's for other singers different, and that you even give us the option to explore it and to also make it my own and not just, you know, whatever, do it as like you do it.
You know what? I think it's a bit like you have a comedian like Charlie Chaplin, and it's really, you have, you know, you have other physical kind of comedians, you know, like Mr. Bean and Charlie Chaplin, let's say, you know. There's so much about how they are as people. And I think because of these pieces that I make, there's a lot of comedy in them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of aggression in them. And I don't think you can dictate how that manifest, you can say it needs to be there, but exactly how it's going to manifest itself in different people, you can't duplicate it. You can't, you know, you can go on stage and pretend to be Charlie Chaplin, but that's not really, you know, unless you're in a sort of, you know, you know, unless you're trying to really make a film about Charlie Chaplin, there's no point in that really, you know. So I mean, I think I'm still writing pieces which are more conventional, let's say, or where the singer has to step into a very specific world that I've made, but that to me seems to be a different thing. So there is also this really interesting thing where you try and, what I think of it as like pinging, chiming the bell of the person, you know, and what do you need to do to chime that bell, you know?
That's very beautiful. And I also feel then that you can let go and trust it onto a performer.
Yeah, I mean, don't you have that? I have this feeling as a performer, when someone gives me a score of some kind, which says, has enough instructions for me to feel I know what the world is, and has enough faith in me, and leaves enough openness for me to do what I want around that, it's really great fun to work with. It's rich, it's really interesting, it's challenging, you know. I guess you know that you have that experience too, you know. And that's a very different experience from, okay, I've got to learn all of this notation. It's really, really, and that's interesting, and it's very rewarding, and it can be great fun, but it's a completely different.
No, process. I totally understand you. And I don't know if I even told it in an English podcast before, but I also had once in a while the experience. I mean, I met so many great composers who I really enjoyed working with, and you have a great conversation, dialogue, and you bring out the best of each, and it's so much fun, and even if it's challenging. But there, I also met a few people where I really had the feeling that they were maybe not even trusting their own music, and they were kind of trying to pull it on me, and then, yeah, there was not a nice atmosphere. And I also felt that I could not do my best, because I always felt, okay, if I do it like this, he might not like it. I mean, since you're done both, I mean, you're performing and composing, what do you yourself appreciate then in performers you work with?
Being open-minded, actually, and being generous in spirit. And I've worked with some very, 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 very well-known people, and I'm not going to name them, who are exceedingly ungenerous in spirit. And I think there is a danger in contemporary, no, the classical music world generally, actually, as an, working a lot with improvisers, it's fascinating how, you know, there are some people who really, they really grow up, let's say, in the jazz world, and they go into more experimental improvisation, and then that world starts to cross over with the contemporary. And yet the institutional background is so utterly, utterly, utterly different. The generosity of spirit is often far greater. I mean, I've also worked with loads of absolutely fantastic, very generous, very open-minded musicians from the contemporary classical world, for sure, lots. But I really notice there's a powerfully distinct institutional background to those two worlds. And it does mean that I've definitely encountered, it's a lot harder in working with contemporary classical musicians coming from this classical background. It can be a lot harder to try things out. It can be a lot, it's just, there's a lot more resistance, you know. And that, I think, is really a shame. I think it's really sad. It's tiring. It's for me, I feel it's unnecessary, but I know why it is. It's because they come from an environment that from very, very young, it's very, very competitive. And I think what can easily happen is personal, your identity, your sense of yourself gets very, very bound up with what you know you can do. And taking a risk and really, really breaking out of that, it's like questioning someone's identity, you know. And I think it's understandable then that it's a very brittle, I think it can be a very brittle environment. I also think that because, and I know it from my time at the Guildhall and the Academy, I had some fantastic teachers, but there were also teachers there who were bastards, you know. And I think within that environment, it's competitive. You have teachers, I think these days, are being held to account a lot more, but there was a lot of kind of unpleasant treatment of vulnerable young people. So, of course, you know, you end up as a very brittle adult. And I think that, I think it's a shame. I think it's really sad. I think it will probably change now. I think it is changing gradually. But I mean, to go back to your question, it's generosity of spirit and open-mindedness and being adventurous, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't hold it against, I think, you know, I'm really aware sometimes I've gone into situations and it's kind of, okay, this, we're just not going to be able to do this because this, these people or this person is just not going to, not having it. And I can see it's really traumatic for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know if I was in another situation with someone, maybe, and more often than not, someone coming from a jazz background, it'd be like, yeah, okay, let's give it a go. Yeah, that's fine, you know. I mean, there's a group called the Alpaca Ensemble. There's the Sonar String Quartet. There's the Neo String Quartet. And there are some people I've worked with. They're absolutely fantastic. Yes, and they will try anything. And, you know, there are plenty of musicians out there. That's just naming a few. So it's not everywhere, but... Yeah. It's very, very interesting to me, those institutional differences. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I also don't believe that you get out the most of a person if you're too competitive or you're just beating on his head or something. I really think if you do it in a more positive, welcoming way, that a lot more things can happen, or at least that's my experience and my belief. But I also feel that I think there are things changing in the young generation, that they are brave, or even those lines are, I think, mixing more between whatever. I mean, we have now many instrumentalists in Germany who also want to be performing and not just play their instrument. They're so really eager for that and curious. And so,
But I think also there's been more light shed generally on the world of forcing children into competitive environments, you know, which has been the thing in the classical music world, you know, you risk getting performing monkeys, people, you know, and it's, I think that maybe that's becoming less and less acceptable now, you know. I mean, I know it's interesting for myself, like I feel my technique, and I know it's for quite a lot of people, you know. I don't think I was technically good as a singer in my early 20s at all. I think I've become through life and through being a bit brave and through being a little, you know, and through trying out many, many different things and meeting people and trying, you know, that actually my techniques got better and better and better and better, you know. Whereas if I had tried to be a classical singer at 20, and I know in that environment they would have just booted me out, you know. So, and I wish that more, I hope that young people know that, you know, that they don't have to take, it's like, it's a weird balance between, of course, when you're young, you need to have some humility. I think actually throughout your whole life, it's quite useful to have some humility, but at the same time to trust your gut and also to know when someone is bullying you or manipulating you, you know. Or just being dismissive because of their own anxieties, you know, that's like a, and I definitely encountered some of those things when I was young, and I remember the pain, but I also remember kind of thinking, you know, up yours, I'm going to do this thing, you're not telling me what I can do, you know, but that experience is very difficult when you're younger.
Yeah, it is. I totally understand you. I mean, that you, I mean, even if you maybe realize that somebody is bullying or manipulating you, you feel in a weak position. I mean, not every student goes up and says, hey, I have a problem. Can somebody help me in this university or so?
Yeah.
Or then you just think, oh, maybe it's just me and something is wrong with me and he's maybe nice to all other students. I mean, there's much... stupid things you can have in your mind then, and also in the end, now when we talk about it, it's also hard to know what is really better. I mean, I said myself, okay, I believe that the positive approach, but I also had to go through difficult, challenging times, and it made me grow.
I completely agree.
I sometimes I'm like, well, maybe it's good that we also have those experiences. I mean,
but I think we can also, I think maybe I could kind of smell, I could detect, sniff out when there was a difference. And actually, I studied with Michael Finnissy composition for 1 year in my postgrad. And I remember the first lesson, he completely slaughtered me. And I came out thinking, yeah, that was just what I needed.
Okay.
You know, because I knew he was on my side.
Ah.
You know, and I think there's a big difference. I think you, like, if someone is really kind you know, so I think it's, we don't need to be handled with kid gloves. I don't think it's good to, also a lot of students, you know, I know it myself. When I was in my 20s, I was often full of crap. You know, it's like you really need someone to help you out. You do, you know. Yeah. You really do. So it's like, it's kind of, and that's what a little bit what I was saying before, like when you're young, have some humility, like you really might think what you're doing is great and it really might not be, you know. So just you know, be prepared to take advice, be prepared to take some, and sometimes it might be hard. But I think it's like, you know, when someone is saying to you, hey, come on, you know, and when someone is actually pushing you around, it's that kind of distinction, you know. So and that, going back to what I was saying, I think putting people into really, really, really competitive environments when they're very, very young, to me, that's just like, oof, it's a killer, you know. Yeah.
We already found out you're a singer, performer, composer, and even a writer. So for me, you have so many facets. How do you organize this, or how do you find a balance, or is there a priority within all those things? I mean, when I look at your website, there's so much Alwin is doing. I'm like, whoa, have you lived already four lives?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually, it's amazing because I spend a lot of time watching Netflix, you know. I'm really like, it's terrifying how much time I spend on the sofa. No, but actually what I think what it is I don't, for me, those things are not separate. Actually, even watching Netflix is not separate, you know. So for me, the kind of the, if I'm working on one thing, I'm very often thinking about the other, or I get ideas from a process of one if I'm working on something that's, you know, text-based. Or it's like, for me, all of these things, they're like this, they're the bubbling to the surface of my experience of being, and trying organizing my experience of being, and organizing it in a way that makes being more surprising and interesting and rich for me. And a little bit going back to, I don't want to promote Netflix too much, let's say HBO, I have subscribed to Mubi, there you go. So Mubi, you know, when you're watching a really great film, you're also thinking, I get ideas, make notes, something, you know. So I don't know, they're not just, I think they're the same thing.
Okay,
it's all intertwined. You know, for me, singing, improvising as a singer is about, I'm very, very, very glad I spent so many years studying and thinking about composing. I think it's incredibly useful for me, you know, this organizing stuff in time. For me, it's really important for me as a singer. And we talked about, okay, when you're a composer and you're writing as a performer, of course, that's really, really useful. And these things all bounce off each other, I think.
Super, super. And how is it for you being a woman in this music world?
Well, I think it's got much better. I think it's got much, 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 much better. And I remember like 30 years ago when I was kind of starting to be a composer in my early 20s, and just very often going along to things and just people assuming that I was somebody's wife, you know. Okay. So that was kind of, I think the world then was more aggressively, specifically male, specifically a very narrow aesthetic. And I mean, I love that aesthetic. I love that world of what kind of contemporary classical music was then. And, you know, all of these guys, Boulez and Stockhausen, they were all still alive. And I was going to the proms and hearing them talk and, you know, hanging out a little bit with them afterwards if I could. But, you know, I was just not on their radar, except, you know, yeah. Anyway, so I think it's improved hugely.
Okay.
I think it's a much, I feel I can be a person more and more, and I hope the direction that we're going on in will continue. You know, that this is about people, and like, well, Martin Lindsay, the baritone who we're working with, he's wearing a nice t-shirt today, which was, what's the kind of washing instructions for human beings, saying they come in all colors, you know, so handle with care or something, I don't know, but it was very nice. Anyway, now I feel a bit like that. It's like we're kind of opening up this distinction of, we're getting away from such clear distinctions of gender, come on, we're just people, we come in all colors, and let's get on and do our thing, and what can we learn from each other, you know. But you do have to maybe push a few statues over the, you know, into the water on the way to kind of get rid of some old models and things. Mm. And I hope that we don't have to, like I say, I mean, I don't, as a person, I don't want to dismiss anything from my past or anything from, you know, like these things are really important. So I guess I don't feel very kind of revolutionary about it in that way, about, let's say, gender politics, but I just feel like I want to be able to breathe a sigh of relief and feel the kind of seams opening up, you know, feel the categories opening up and feel the water running in, the air running in, and, you know, and so for me, maybe that's a better kind of way of thinking about where we might go. In the past, had many wonderful things about it and many ridiculous things. And it'll be the same in 50 mm-hmm. years' time. We'll look back at where we're moving into now and we'll see the limitations of that. So the thing is just to stay a little bit humble and compassionate, open-minded, work hard, keep moving forward.
Yes, it's good for everybody.
Yes.
You also curate a festival, Borealis?
Not anymore.
Not
I did.
Anymore.
No, I actually stopped 6 years ago.
Oh, that long.
Yeah, long okay. time ago. But I did start last year with my partner when we got some funding from a local council from Bergen Comuna to do a festival in our... We have this ridiculously big garden
okay.
and a terrace, and we wanted to do a drive-in festival.
Aww.
And we did a beautiful... One day, we organised it all the day before so we could guarantee really great weather and that people could drive in with the COVID regulations mm-hmm. last year and sit in the garden. Mm-hmm. And we have a big, big terrace, which was the stage. So we're going to do it again this year. So maybe I've started a new festival. I'm okay. not sure.
And how old is... Oh, say it again.
Sletterfest.
Okay.
That's where we live. It's called Sletter. It's the bus stop.
Okay.
So it's, so it's really in the name of our tiny little area. But it was much more... What was nice was a real mixture of music. We yeah. had really everything you can imagine was then we ended with an African, like a Pan-African band. And
cool.
we had a real mixture. We had some modular synthesizers playing. We had some...
you will give me the link. I will put it into the
yes.
show notes.
I'm going to see. We have a really nice video actually from the festival.
Cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
And how is curating for you or was it for you?
Yeah, well, what I like about Sletterfest is we don't really curate it. We phone around a bunch of our friends the day before and we see who's available. And I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've become a bit tired of curators.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the people who speak best, you know, you go to festivals... And there's a theme and there's a lot of administration around it. There's something really nice about opening festival is it's really very light on that kind of front, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's because of Bernd Leffert and Thomas Rath and they have this human quality
yeah.
and somehow they always, I mean, I've sang here quite a lot, always draw nice people and somehow it fits and
yeah.
it's so nice.
But it's administratively really, really light.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. And also, you know, when you've got an artist at the helm, it makes a difference, you know, someone who's an actual practitioner. And I think there are a lot of money goes into administration. A lot of money goes into kind of organising musicians. Mm. A lot of musicians are kind of competing to... I think we should just let musicians play
yes.
and listen to them and maybe less worrying about the frames around it. But that's where I am at the moment. And I'm sure it's important that festivals are curated and things. It's just for me at this point in my life, I'm kind of a bit done with it. But, you know, that's also having done it for...
You have done it for quite a while.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was really... You did ask me what I thought of it at the time. And it was exceedingly rewarding and very, very challenging and exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a performer and a composer, 6 years was enough, actually,
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a great kind of weight of responsibility, too, to all the mm-hmm. musicians mm-hmm. and the people that, you know. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I kind of want to say, come on, guys, everybody come and we'll just make some music, which is kind of what we do at Sletterfest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nice. Yeah. Also, this experience did something with you. I mean, we now heard how many different things you do. How do you live through your day? Or do you have some kind of time management? Or how do you get all those things done?
Yeah, I mean, so I have like different systems. So I vary my systems, actually. But I'm very systematic. And I normally make a list the day before mm-hmm. of what I want to do the next day. You know, so I'm quite kind of... I don't fulfill that list, but I like to have a guide.
Mm-hmm.
So I normally like to go to bed at night thinking, okay, tomorrow I know that I'm going to be getting up and doing this. Now, sometimes I get up ridiculously early, like 5-6 o'clock in the morning, and I sit down with coffee and I just work for 3 or 4 hours before I have breakfast. But actually in the last year, because I haven't really been going anywhere, I've actually not been setting an alarm at all, and I've been getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's been really nice because I've got more time to work at home, you know. I mean, generally, I work in the morning and then I have lunch and then I have a little siesta.
I love siesta too.
Yeah, I always have a siesta. And I normally read, I lie on the sofa and I read something, you know, and I've got a lot of huge reads that I like to read a lot. I've got some reading, so I read and then I sleep and then I go back to work. And then I work anything from till 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 at night. It just depends what's going on, you know. And then but actually also in the last year, I've been doing yoga at night from 10 till 11:30, even 11 till 12, something like that. So really late. And then before I hit the sack, you know. So, but it's very easy for me. I don't have children. I have a partner who's also an artist. And I mean, my days, I generally have 3 or 4 projects that I'm working on in a day. So like at the minute, I'm composing a piece for the Natural History Museum in Bergen. So I work on that for a few hours. And then I have another piece I'm working on for the Alpaca Ensemble. So I work on that for a few hours. And then I'm also doing some writing work for a project for next year. So, So I normally do 2 or 3 projects a day, actually. And then I do some admin and stuff. And, and then occasionally I have days where I only work on one thing. Mm. And definitely the closer I get to a deadline, everything else falls away. Yeah, yeah. And then sometimes I'll just work for weeks. You know, and I'll just... Sometimes I came to Berlin, actually, when I was working my orchestral piece and just stayed in a hotel. You know, and I just worked... I worked really weird hours.
You have a very good focus.
Yes.
What are you thankful for today?
Well, actually, today I am amazingly thankful for doing this job that I do because... And for being in Germany. Because I haven't... This is the first time I've travelled since February last year outside Norway. And it's really interesting getting, you know, flying and suddenly being in Germany. It was like I had never traveled before.
Really?
Coming to a foreign country, it was like, gosh, it's so interesting. You hear foreign languages, a foreign language, you hear German, and the weather's different, and everything smells different. And then sitting in a room with all of the performers for tomorrow that we did today, it's this is so exciting. This is wonderful, you know. And I think that one thing this last year has kind of, I realize coming here, you know, I only arrived last night, so I realize being here today, it's like I've been reborn as a, you know, like, and it's kind of, okay, so don't lose this. Mm-hmm. Don't lose how strange and wonderful it is to be able to do this, you know, because I think before, actually when everything shut down last year, I was a bit relieved, I was tired. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, okay, actually, I don't think I'm going to leave. By June last year, I was thinking, I don't think I'm going to leave the house again. I'm going to find a way that I can just stay at home for the rest of my life, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started to feel. And, of course, give it another 6 months and I couldn't wait to get out of the house. But, you know, I definitely was tired. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thankful for being a musician and being able to work with a whole bunch of wonderful other people and being able to travel, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel very thankful for that today.
And what does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in this, what we call music business? And how do you keep true to yourself?
You know, I think I haven't worked out. I don't have a take on what either the word true or the word self mean. So it's really hard for me to answer that. I don't, for me, like this, how I move forward is, I mean, it sounds incredibly simplistic in a way, but it's breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe, look, listen, breathe, wait, watch, breathe. You know, and it's kind of, I mean, it's a very kind of primeval thing in a way. Like maybe for me that it would be as something as basic as that.
Mm.
You know, that it's, for me, it's in the breath. But it's not really answering your question. But I don't
find it interesting. I mean, it's you're observing, but you also seem to take the time and not just to rush somewhere. And then you maybe really feel yourself or maybe feel your answer if whatever I should take on this job or not. I don't know if it goes into that direction.
Yeah, the gut. Maybe I'm feeling it more and more. It's like follow your gut. But also, I've said it so many times, it's a bit, have some compassion, have some humility. At the same time, like, do what you really need to do. Mm-hmm. So it's like humility, isn't it? But, you know, just be like everybody's... I don't understand the world. I don't understand other people's difficulties and their suffering. Sometimes they really piss me off.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also... That's also... I can also find that... In fact, mm-hmm. often it pisses me off. I get very... You know, it's interesting that I talk about being slow and because basically I'm super hyper.
Yeah, I mean, what everything you get done or... So I mean, there is also saying, how does it go? Hurry slowly.
Yeah.
And I find there's also lots of truth because if you really in yourself, in your gut or your ground, then you make different decisions or you whatever, or your, if I take another picture, then your whatever, your knife is really sharp when you do hit something. And maybe it is the preparation before. And then afterwards, some people just see, oh, she has done that. Oh, it looks so easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think also there's a lot to be said in my own experience of life for what happens when you... If I stop trying to tell myself what I think things should be, like truth and self, if I stop trying to define truth, I stop trying to define self, because that's a lot of conversations going on in my head when I do that. And I mean, I do often try to do that. But actually, when when I let those conversations go in my internal conversations and monologues, and I, it's like, okay, do you know what? Actually, I have really no idea. It doesn't matter either, mm-hmm. you know. But I'll tell you what, whatever I do next, let's make sure that I'm not too horrific to the people around me. You know, let's make sure that it's going to be exciting and interesting for me. If it's not, maybe don't do it, mm-hmm. you know. So it kind of like letting a lot of stories go clears the head for the gut to mm-hmm. say, hey, you know what? Yeah, why not? Let's, mm-hmm. yeah, no, I don't think, you know, and it, I think that my experience of life is that the more I've shut down the voices and the more I've allowed the, mm-hmm. the breath or the gut to lead me, the more it's like, okay, and actually, I don't know, maybe it wasn't the right decision, maybe it wasn't, but I'm going with it. And mm-hmm. in fact, you know, and then I realized that in fact, you never know where your life is going to take you. You never know. So, yeah.
What does success mean for you?
I think for me, do you mean like success in the abstract, or what would be like a successful day, or
whatever you want to tell us, or whatever it means for you, or what you can apply to it?
I think success is a feeling of interest and joy, kind of excitement and joy at my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I wake up in the morning, or even when I'm going to bed at night and I'm thinking about what I'm doing tomorrow, and I feel it's a good thing, you know, there's a kind of quiet excitement around it. And if whilst I'm doing it, and it doesn't mean it's always the case, often whilst I'm doing things, there's like, well, of course, all kinds of difficulties around them, but being, again, also being patient with those. And then when I get to the other end of the day, looking back and saying, okay, even if I didn't manage to achieve anything, that the process was exciting and interesting, or the process was, I don't know, like just the texture of it was rich. Mm. The texture of it was rich, and to be patient enough and meticulous enough to trust that if I stick with it, something will come of it, you know? So I think kind of being in that zone, that for me is, that's when I feel that this beingness of life is success, you know, mm-hmm. is successful. And when I lose track of that and I get like, again, and then there are voices in the head, or then mm-hmm. I, you know, and all kinds of tensions come in the body or whatever. And then I feel like, no, this is, I'm not doing this successfully. Mm-hmm. This is not working. So, yeah.
Is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have a vision?
I am pretty certain that if I wasn't going to die in the next, at least in the next 40 years, if I'm lucky, 50 years, if I'm kind of assuming I'm going to live to 100, that I'm not sure I would work in the way I do. So I think probably death is a strong driving force for me. But also knowing that my friend, you know, all of these relationships I have with other artists, with my friends, with my family, with my partner, that they are very temporary,
mm-hmm.
you know. We're not going to be here for very long. And I think I remember when I think I must have been about 7 or 8, and I don't know what happened, but I became terrified of death. And I remember being at a birthday party and crying because there were candles on the table, and I felt that that could mean the house could burn down. And, you know, like I really was immobilized by mm-hmm. this realization that I was going to die. And I guess it probably happens to a lot of kids. And I don't know when it went away, because I really felt like it was never going to go, you know, it was going to make life completely insufferable. And it did somehow go away. But I think I sort of absorbed it into somewhere mm-hmm. deep inside me. And I never felt very, I've always really surprised that I made it through another day, actually. You know, that does quite surprise me. I made it through another day and my family's still here. You know, I feel incredibly lucky mm-hmm, in that. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something very fragile then about existence, that I do feel that the institutions that we live inside, whether it's even the institution of family, everything about culture, mm-hmm. I'm like using institutions in the broadest sense of the word. It's so weird that we made them up. It's so that we invented these things mm-hmm. and we live by them. And I always feel like just on the edge of, maybe it's madness actually, of not being able to relate to them at all. They just mm-hmm. seem so crazy. All these things that we do and we get, mm-hmm. and we do, you know, how we live and... But I like being in that liminal zone on the edge, you know, because then there's this feeling that just beyond it is this magnificent, weird universe that, I mean, it's also in it. It's also in all the institutions, mm-hmm. of course, and there are plenty of artists who make wonderful work about mm-hmm. this, the way that we live. But I guess I kind of, inhabiting that area that's somewhere between the everyday and, you know, everything that feels like we're trying to organize out of existence. I think that really, really, really fascinates me. And I'm glad that it feels to me like making art is the only place where I can really be with that experience, you know. So maybe those things. And I mean, it's just really fun to make stuff. It's great when you've made something. I mean, I often make things that I don't think are very good. But then I, you know, I make things that I, some things I made I thought were really fabulous, you know, and I'm really, really glad I made them. I'm really glad that came into the world, and especially projects where I'm working with quite a lot of other people and they also really enjoyed that play. And I feel like, yeah, I'm, you know, yeah, I'm kind of contributed somehow to the world being a marginally more interesting, better place.
Well, I could probably talk with you for another hour. We might have dinner now.
Yes.
But I want to ask you my last question. Which tip would you like to give young artists?
Yes, maybe I kind of did already with this. I mean, I was talking before about being open-minded and but I think, well, it's a difficult one. I think it's this somewhere between be deadly serious about what you do and also don't take yourself too seriously. Maybe it's maybe that would kind of encapsulate kind of many different things that I've said, you know, like just deadly serious, life and death. And also it, maybe it just doesn't matter and nothing matters. Like how to play that, how to walk that super, super fine line in such a way that, I mean, I know artists are meant to suffer for their art, and I think human existence seems to me impossible to do without suffering, so I'm really not sure that it's necessary to bring that into art. I would say find your joy, you know? I think it's really important, even in suffering, like the richness of suffering, you know? And I think there's been a lot of the narrative around the suffering artist, I think, is kind of bullshit, actually, and I think there's been a lot of that. You know, I think the... And it becomes a hierarchy thing. It's a way of kind of... you know, holding power over people that you suffer for your art. Everybody suffers, you know. Find your joy, find your power in your joy. Also, I think that's important. Yeah, maybe that's enough.
Well, thank you so much, Alma.
Thank you. Thank you.
For being here with me in my podcast. And yeah, we're looking forward to our performance and have a great time in Trier. And I wish you all the best for all the projects you're planning and coming up.
Thank you so much. That was great. I really enjoyed it.
This was the interview with Arwin Pritchard. I hope that this interview inspired you, and I welcome you to write to me through email or Facebook. I like the interaction with you. Thank you so much that you have tuned within me today. And I really hope that you liked it that and that inspired you. I would be very happy if you could tell your friends and colleagues about my podcast. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.